Hello, everyone. This is Jason Lin, and welcome to the Linsider podcast, where it is my job to discuss the entertainment industry from a cross-cultural and interdisciplinary perspective. I spent half my professional career working and living in Asia, and the other most recent half working and living in the US, specifically LA. As someone with this experience, I'm covering the entertainment industry with perspectives I don't hear frequently. To kick off my podcast, I am lucky to welcome my good friend, Kenny Liu, as my very first guest. Kenny is an actor best known for his role as Zhu Xuesan in Roland Emmerich's Midway and Sergeant Eddie Chen in Nat Geo's The Long Road Home. He is recognized worldwide as Gohan from the viral hit Dragon Ball Z Light of Hope, which garnered 34 million views. Born in Taipei and raised in the Bay Area, Kenny excelled in academics and sports. He attended UC Berkeley, Go Bears, majoring in mechanical engineering and Chinese. Kenny's breakout role, lead role, is in the indie feature A Shot Through the Wall by Amy Long. Another upcoming project is Yakuza Princess, the highly anticipated Japanese-Brazilian adaptation from Marvel writer Danilo Beirut and director Vicente Amorim. The film will release later this year. I've known Kenny as a good friend for about 5 years, and I can't wait for you to get to know him better. Through this discussion, I actually learned many new things about Kenny. This is my goal for the podcast, simply to sit down with my good friends and have an engaging conversation. It's nourishing for my soul, and I hope you will enjoy it as well. Please help me spread the good word of this podcast by giving a rating and sharing on social channels. Much love, and let's get to it. Hello, Kenny Liu.
Hey, very nice to be a part of this podcast with you, Jason.
Thank you. The first episode, the pilot, if you will, of The Linsider. So thank you for joining, Kenny, and thank you for agreeing to be my guest.
It is an absolute honor to be here, to be interviewed by the one and only Jason Lin.
Hey, we are all one of one, is what I like to say.
That's very true.
Kenny, let's get started. Tell me a little bit about you. A brief intro.
Very briefly, I'm a first generation immigrant son of Taiwanese parents. Grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. Went to school at Berkeley. Studied something completely unrelated to the arts or acting. I did engineering for a very long time. Even worked as a web developer for a long time in Silicon Valley. Did well there, and then got lucky enough where I had the chance to transition into acting. And so I've been doing that professionally in Los Angeles. It's been about 7 years now and met some really great people along the way, such as yourself, that want to tell really great Asian-centered stories. And yeah, that's why I'm here, a part of this.
Thank you so much. I can tell you do this for a living.
Really?
I have a lot of follow-up questions, but let's start from the beginning. So give me a sense, a little bit about your family, and tell me a little bit about young Kenny. What were your hopes and dreams as a kid? What did you want to become?
Man, what did I want to become? I don't even think I wanted to become anything. I just wanted to get my hands on the latest game. My dad was like pretty strict, especially when I was younger. And then he's an immigrant and he knows how hard it was to like make it. And so he's always telling me, don't waste your time, don't waste your time. And of course, that made me like really crave playing games and stuff. But then, so I did that. And then I had all kinds of classes that we were taking because my mom is somebody who grew up in a time in Taiwan where you didn't have a lot of opportunities. And so then she lived through us vicariously. So I took so many different classes, like anything you can name. We did like Chinese school, Chinese brush. We did ballet. Mm-hmm. Ice skating, tap dancing, horseback riding classes, abacus classes, to where I like became almost like a professional like abacus mental math user. Piano I played for 12 years and was competing. We did taekwondo, and it just goes on and on. So my childhood was kind of like that. It was very regimented in a way, like our days were like from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. type of thing. But then it wasn't like militant. It was just a family, very close-knit, without many relatives. And so then I think that was just how we filled our time. And yeah, it was very exciting because there was always something new every single day. And we didn't have much, but then at least we had all these classes and like each other and stuff. Yeah.
Wow, that's really amazing. I guess the interesting thing that I find there is that besides things that you hear of very often, like piano or abacus, like you had this world of other things. I haven't heard that many stories about my friends who in their childhood did ballet and you mentioned all the other these other things. Yeah. Did you, was it, you mentioned it was regimented. Were your days like really planned out by like hours, like blocked?
Basically, well, it wasn't like necessarily by hour. It was like every day was like, okay, every Tuesday is our piano classes. Mm. And then because we were doing piano so seriously, at one point we were practicing like 4 hours a day. And so then it was like, well, I have to do my practice today. So in that way, it was regiment. It was like goal-focused days. And then we had to fit everything in type of thing.
Mm-hmm. And when you mentioned games earlier, what, you mean video games or just video fun games?
Video games.
Okay. Video games. Awesome. Sure. And what were your favorite games growing up? What systems did you have to play?
I only had the regular Nintendo. That's been a long time. But yeah, we had the original Mario. We had Duck Hunt. We had Mario 2, Mario 3, Contra. Yeah. No, I never had Contra. I had Double Dragon. Shoot. I had so many different games and all the hardest ones.
Like, yes.
It became a point of pride to be able to beat it because they were very hard games. I remember beating Double Dragon 3 and all my friends were like, how the fuck did you do that?
Oh, I love that game.
Double Dragon 3, did you ever beat that?
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think there are very few games that I beat. I only remember beating Mario and Super Mario 3.
Super Mario 3. And regular Mario you beat too?
I think so.
Wow, I remember there was one stage that was really hard. I think it was the last stage.
It gets crazy with the rotating fires and stuff like that.
And I also think the time limit.
Yeah, the time limit.
Yeah, we'll see later. We'll play a game. But yeah, that was basically life. Maybe in a way it was my escape in a way because it was so regimented. It was like, oh, I wanted something outside of it too. And it was so exciting too. If you grew up in the 80s and the 90s, then freaking video games were your jam.
Do you recall at that age if you had, like, what kind of interest you had in entertainment? And did it ever cross your mind that you wanted to be, like, on screen?
Definitely. One of the things that I fell into in my middle school was acting. You know, I took an extracurricular class, a drama, and right away, like the teacher, her name is Mrs. Harrington, and I grew up in it was this middle school that was pretty rural, suburban, and it was like 80% Filipino. I felt like the odd one out. I'm one of the few Chinese people around, and she really took a liking to me. And so then right away, she cast me in the lead of every single play for the next 2 or 3 years. So then we had several different plays. We had the school play every year. But we also had this, it was called the GATE program. It was like the advanced type thing. And they're doing Shakespeare. And so I got cast as Romeo. I got cast as Pyramus in Midsummer Night's Dream when we were just doing like the short segment of it. So then I was always the lead of these plays. And I really got bit by the acting bug throughout middle school. And I was like, it became a part of my reputation in a way. People were like, oh yeah, he's the actor I see all the time. And at that point we were writing our own things and stuff too. And then as soon as it reached high school, I was like, oh, it's time to get serious with life. And I didn't see anybody on screen that was Asian. And I didn't even know that this was happening subconsciously, but then it did. And the narrative that I told myself was, oh, okay, it's time to grow up and do something real. And so I completely let it go. It wasn't like my parents convinced me or anything where they were like, oh, this is a waste of time. It was something I told myself. And so then I completely dropped it in high school because I knew I had to start preparing for college. And I did end up doing a play then, but it was only because I was forced into it. But we didn't have to get into that. I did nothing in college. Zero.
That's so interesting that you mentioned that because that childhood experience shapes you. Yeah. I guess I'm curious, what do you think attributed to that kind of thinking when you were at that age, like thinking that you had to grow up and that this wasn't serious? Was it the peer kind of environment? Because you mentioned it wasn't your parents.
Yeah, it was.
Maybe you could also mention like where you grew up. You mentioned like lots of Filipinos.
It was Union City, California, in the Bay Area. It's East Bay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's like in between Fremont and Oakland. And so it's not like even one of those like mid-sized towns. But what contributed, I think, to the mindset, I think, was just an expectation of you. I think like it's interesting. You don't, as you're growing up, you accept everything as it comes in. And then so I put myself in a box because I think that's just the way that things were expected of me as a minority growing up in the suburbs. It was just like what life set out for me. And it wasn't a fight. It was just the way it is. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, I just accepted it. Yeah. So I think really that was the mindset.
Do you recall, this is interesting, I love this type of getting to know you because I haven't known a lot of these details, but both our parents moved here from Taiwan. And for your parents, have you ever asked them why they moved to the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. That's like our superhero origin story.
Yeah.
Like,
what was that for your family? What was the specific reason?
For my family, it was my mom came from like a wealthier family. And then my dad came from a much poorer family, like pretty dang poor. And then she was the type of person that always encouraged him to get out and try new things. And one of the things that happened was when my dad was about 30, he really struggled to find a job. And he was like working in kitchens. His brother like is a chef and owns like a small hole in the wall. He was working there for a while and he was just like dissatisfied with what opportunities he had. So then my mom, using what money she had, she was like, let's study in America together. And so then she paid for their education and they ended up getting into a graduate school in Texas where they studied computer science together. So it was in that way, it was like a classic immigrant story, especially from people from Asia, is that it was through education. And my dad was like, okay, I don't know anything about computers, but I just know it's the future. He was like this really gruff, is this really gruff, like athletic guy. And he played sports in college and he broke like some records, like at his college for like track and like shot put and stuff. But he also had a moment where he was like, wow, it's time to get serious with my life. And he threw it all away. Like he studied computer science, which he really hated. He wanted to support his family. And so then he just like bit the bullet and like really suffered through like computer science classes. And then worked as a programmer for a while. And then my mom actually never worked as one. And she's freaking brilliant. Like my dad was always telling her, reminding me that she's like, yeah, she's got an IQ of 150. And she's incredibly smart, but she never worked as one. Like she never worked as a programmer, ever had a full-time job, at least in America. So she became a housewife. And that, I think that was what contributed to all the very exciting, stimulating things that we got to learn as kids. Mm-hmm. I have two sisters, so it was like the three of us like getting carted around every day, like different things.
Talk a little bit about, I think, your story. As I got to know you over the years, I think your story of basically having acting be your second career, mm-hmm. and also at such a young age, right, is very interesting because you had a full first career before that. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? Give a little bit of a backdrop, any details or highlights of your career.
Absolutely. That's a really transformative thing for me. I got bit by this acting bug in middle school and it was so much a part of my identity. And I always had it in the back of my mind that this was something that would be really great for me to do for myself. But then I let it go. And then I studied engineering. I ended up going to UC Berkeley for mechanical engineering. And while I was in college there, I was pretty unhappy because it was a whole thing about being mature enough to take care of myself. But anyway, so then I ended up working as a web developer in the corporate world for a year and a half. And then my friends and I decided to start our own company, which was like this legal startup called Law Pivot. And we ended up getting invested in by Google. We were working out of their startup labs for a couple of years. Where they basically are rent for using their office and getting food and getting free classes for anything. Like every week was like $5 a month.
And what year really was this? Cool.
This was 2011 to 2013. But before that, we thought we were going to go under and we were working out of my parents' place. It was really like this pipe dream, but then it happened. And then suddenly we were working at Google Startup Labs out of their office for a little while. And then we got bought by another company called Rocket Lawyer, which I ended up working at for almost a year. And then during all of that time, when I was being a web developer at this startup, I found acting again. Yeah, it's always about the people along the way that kind of find you. There's this guy who I just, right after college, and this is like when I was working corporate still, I was like, I'm so bored on the weekends. And I just was like, I used to love acting. Let's just audition for things on Craigslist.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And that was normal back then, right? That wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was still weird even back right. then, but
you had you've heard those stories of people trying to make it, and
yeah,
it took and some gig off of Craigslist. I think even it still happens now that when they look for extras and things like that.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. And yeah, and it's still happening now. Like a lot of short films are still being cast in Craigslist. Anyway, so then there was this feature film about, it was an Asian American story feature film. It was paying $800 for the lead. And then, so then I was like, oh, let's go audition for it. And then I auditioned for it and ended up getting this part. And it wasn't because, you know, I was like this really talented actor or anything. I think the part really fit me as a person. And, but then on set, there was this guy, his name is Tom Lin. No relation to you.
lots of Lins, yeah.
Yeah, lots of Lins out there. But he was this acting coach on set, and he is like a very successful guy. I think he's working at Google and then Yahoo or something like that as an executive. And he's Taiwanese too. And he met me and he was like, wow, this guy's got something to him. And then so he was like, I want to start my own management company in the Bay Area, and I want you to be my first client. And then I was like, oh yeah, of course. And then I drove to his house in San Francisco from East Bay, which is a 40-minute drive over the bridge, every week. And we were just working on monologues. I did that with him for 1 or 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was like, yeah, I used to be an actor in Los Angeles for a few years, but then I gave it all up because I wanted to take care of my family. And that's why he worked corporate. And anyway, so then I can live vicariously through you. And I just wanted to help you. And it was, this guy was a bit older than me, maybe 7 years.
Not that much older.
Yeah, yeah, not that much older.
Because the way you said that, what he said to you, it sounds like someone that's 50 or retired would say to the next generation.
Yeah.
And he's your peer.
Exactly. And in a way, that's like the immigrant thing too, where it's like, oh, you feel the pull for taking care of your family. And then there's like, the things that you want to do too. And he chose that route. And it was because of him that I even ever had this idea of, oh, I can maybe try being an actor. And it was because of him that I got represented by the best agency in the Bay Area, which isn't saying too much, but at least it became a part-time job for me. So then I was doing the startup during the day. And then on the nights and on the weekends, I was acting. And everything. I did 40 short films and 40 commercials in the Bay Area during those 3 years that I was working at a startup. Yeah, I did a whole shitload.
Like, yeah.
So much.
That sounds like a full-time job in addition to your full-time job.
Yeah. But then it also told me too, like the amount of energy that I had for it was just like, it was so clear, like what my being was telling me. And so then, yeah, that was when I was like, oh, wow, this might be something that I can do otherwise. And then when this opportunity came up where we sold our company, I had some money. I was like, what do I want to do with my life now? My bucket list was I wanted to do a startup and do something to help change the world. And I don't think we necessarily changed the world, but I did do this startup and I checked it off. And then I think I was like 27, 28 at the time. And then I was like, yeah, let's see what acting is like. That's when I moved down to Los Angeles. And it's been about like 7 years since then.
Go back a little bit to what you mentioned about, like you said, 40 short films, 40 commercials. Do you have any context, any idea, like for someone coming up that time at that level, was that a lot? Was that normal?
No, like, that was not normal. People usually are, I think, a little bit more discerning about what they do. I think I had an energy to me and stuff that kind of made me like try to go out for as much as I could, because it was almost subconscious, like the need to act. Like I just, it was something that I still don't understand to this day, but there was just this enormous drive to get in front of the camera, to practice, to meet people and do this thing. And maybe it was because I didn't believe that I could ever do it, that I was like, well, it's my only chance. So shoot, let's just do as much of it as I can. And then I realized how much I truly loved it. It wasn't to become famous. It wasn't to have this dream career or anything. It was just strictly out of the love for it. I just spent so much energy on it. And so much of it came out to be just pure garbage. But there were quite a few of them. I got really lucky and they did really well. What I learned from it was that you can think that you're really smart. You know, I went to Berkeley and I can think I'm very analytical about myself, but then I did realize that there's things that your whole like inner being is telling you that you wouldn't even find out until like years later.
That's so interesting. And then, so what was the next step of that journey? You sold the company and then you moved down to LA?
Moved down to LA.
And then you just decided to move down? Did you have anyone, almost that guide relationship that you had with Tom?
No, it was really like moving to Los Angeles for a lot of people. I think for most people is you really had to start over. During my first year in Los Angeles was really just establishing relationships. You can have these high dreams and you're like, oh, I'm going to start auditioning. I'm going to start getting parts right away. Dude, even to audition is a miracle.
Even with the fact that you came with all these short films and you had done these commercials. Uh-huh. So like clearly you have experience and you can show people you've done this.
None of that counted. Like zero cred at all. Like even I had this one.
And why? Film. Because they were, what, why?
It just wasn't, to them, it wasn't legitimate. It wasn't a TV show. It wasn't from another country. It wasn't like a big feature film. Even though all the short films that I did, like one of them went all over the United States and a couple of them did really well critically and popular wise. Like one of them like even got chosen to play at a local movie theater for a week. It was like this action comedy called Love Hurts. And that was really a lot of fun to shoot and there was some action in that. But anyway, so then that won a bunch of awards, including ones in Hollywood. It won Audience Choice Award at Holly Shorts and another film festival in Los Angeles, but none of it counted. Like zero. It was really luck that ended up landing me with a really great agent. I knew that I had like a decent look. And so my strategy really was to just be seen. And so I was paying for a bunch of these agent workshops where they can just see me. After understanding the lay of the land a little bit, you really had to build from scratch as soon as you got to Los Angeles. You had to be like, okay, what is this like? And you start finding out that the commercial world is completely different than the theatrical world. Mm-hmm. But then the easiest thing to do was to get a commercial agent because you don't really need too much acting ability in order to star in a commercial. So then I was like, I'm going to go to these commercial acting workshops. And then right away I got picked up by a decent one and started going out on commercials a little bit here and there. But then I got really lucky to find my theatrical agent, which is like 10 times harder to get a commercial agent. Her name is Sarah Beth Shadeen. And she was this new agent that moved to, at the time I was with Sovereign Talent. And she became their main like theatrical agent. And I got really lucky because she's been in town for a very long time and knows a lot of people and is very reputable. And she saw my headshot just sitting on the desk of my commercial agent in Sovereign Talent. Mm-hmm. And she was like, oh, who is this guy? And they were like, blah, 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 he's new. And she was like, okay, well, I'd like to meet him. And so then the next time I came in to visit the agency, which is one of those things I read online, like you should do that like every year or something. So I remember I was visiting my commercial agency and then she was like, oh, hey, I want to chat with you. And so then I just chatted with her for 5 minutes in the lobby. And then sure enough, like she hip pocketed me, which means I'm not officially signed, but she wanted to see what I was like. And she sent me out to a few of her friends in the casting offices to, you know, see what my feedback is. That's how I'm still with her now. She ended up moving to BRS Gage, where I still am now. And yeah, I'm still with her to this day. It's about 6 years now, but it was freaking luck.
So thinking back, actually, I guess we met right when you had moved to LA. And actually at that time, was it 2014, 2015?
No, it was later than that. I think I'd been in town for 2 or 3 years by that time.
Wait, so when did you move down here?
2014 January.
That's when I moved back to LA too, but I guess we didn't we didn't meet until a year or two later. Now you've been in LA since 2014 and you've built your career and you continue to work at it. What are some, looking back, I know you still have a long way to go, but just in these few years, what were some of the surprises for you?
It's nonstop surprises, dude. Like Los Angeles and it depends. It's huge and there's a lot of things that can go wrong. There's a lot of things that can go right.
Maybe obviously. One positive surprise and one thing that is not as positive.
The things that are not as positive, it's going to be much harder than you think. It's going to attack you in ways that you're not going to even expect. What's good about realizing that is you start to realize what is important and what is valuable to keep close to your chest, to be able to weather the constant rejection, the constant failures, and it's constant. But like, just expect that, oh yeah, like things are gonna mess up no matter how much you try. But then the attitude isn't to stop trying. It's to say, okay, that might happen, but because I believe in this so much, I'm going to keep on doing my best. Mm-hmm. And then finding people that you really resonate with and realize that it's not about getting that result. It's about creating something wonderful with people that you connect with, connecting further to yourself. And that's always going to be a win. Like, it's never going to be a waste of time or a loss or a failure in that way. So that for me was like my discovery that came from having that negative realization. Something really positive can come out of it. And it really makes you a lot stronger if you are able to adapt with all the shit that gets thrown in your way.
I'm just listening to what you said, and it actually sounds very meditative, like the approach that you have to this journey. I'm curious, is that just kind of part of your personality, or what are some things that you've done for your mental well-being or for your self-care?
I think it's a combination of both. Mm. I think especially for a long time in my life, I really wasn't thinking. You know, things were given to me and I had to digest them, like my regimented classes and whatever. But then after you do enough things, like you start to innately know that some things are truer than others. And so in that way, like as all this shit was getting thrown to me in Los Angeles, I got some really freaking crazy wild stories that we don't have to get into. But then you start to realize that, oh, okay, wait a minute, that's not exactly what I want. And then it just keeps getting more and more honed. So in a way, on the side of acting, I realized that what was more important than just the acting was who you are as a human being, because that, I believe, heavily informs your talent as an actor, one, but also what you ultimately want to represent as an artist.
Mm.
When I realized that was when I was like, okay, well, that means I have to become a better person, essentially. And so then a lot of that was like reading a lot of philosophy, a lot of like pop philosophy, talking to friends, talking to people, doing a lot of inner work. I had something traumatic that happened to me for a long time in my life that had to do with my parents that actually got me into acting in the first place, that I can talk a little bit more about in a bit. That awakened me to, this is why I want to do this. And having that sense given to me became my true north. And so then whatever it was that I read or studied, it was finding that feeling again is how it works for me. And then after I felt, I was like, this is who I am, was when I realized, oh, okay, now I went from zero to one. And that one, the next step is to find people around me that match with that one that I finally identify with. Mm-hmm. And that's where you came in, and that's where Masumi came in, and that's where like all these friends that I have now that I realize, wow, this is what I want to stand for. So that's what happened for me, like maybe a couple of years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, where I really felt like, wow, I feel like I'm finally at one now. Yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. It sounds almost like the ability that you had to connect with it, I connect those things. And I love how at moments of your life and how you've not only connected it, but you've recognized that something, someone that has helped you along this journey. I think that's so hard because this industry is so cutthroat, and I'm on the producing side, so it's different. But you being in front of the camera as an actor, that's so hard. I've read the stories and you see the depictions on film and TV. I'm curious, just before we forget, you mentioned something traumatic with your parents. Can you talk a little bit about it? Whatever you're comfortable with.
Yeah. How do I get into this? Basically, the essence of it is, as young as I can remember, my relationship with my father was not the best. He had a lot of pressure to be able to support a family, and he was going through a lot. And then I don't think, when you grow up in that time, in specifically an Asian country, I think you don't have a lot of the tools you need to express yourself, to communicate your emotions. You just don't have those tools. And so I think he had a lot of things bottled up. And in a way, I was the only son, and he ended up taking a lot out on me. And that was my earliest memories. And it went on for quite a long time, to a point where it had happened between 3 to 10, like it's a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that like when it happens to you that young, at least for me, as I became an adult and stuff, up until I started acting, I was like, oh yeah, that's normal. That's what life is. Like, it's given to you in a box. And so you're like, oh yeah, everybody goes through that. I believe that subconsciously. And I think why acting was so powerful for me was because I think I really struggled with understanding myself all that time. And kind of why Berkeley for me was such a mess was because my inner life was in turmoil and I didn't know it. I was just always being busy and saying, okay, let me study this and you get this grade. And you're so busy busying yourself so that you don't have to look within. And I didn't have the tools either. But then acting for me, I became like decent at analyzing characters and stuff. And it became really fascinating. And then you develop this lens. And then at some point, you're going to turn that lens on yourself. And that was when I was like, oh, wow, who is this Kenny guy? He's very interesting. He's got these very strong characteristics that come out of somewhere. And then it was when I had to write for homework class. I was taking this acting class at the Beverly Hills Playhouse in San Francisco. It's now called ZA Studios under Robert Zimmerman. One of my homeworks was to do this personal monologue. And basically you write like a 10-minute monologue, you memorize it, you perform it for the class, and you can write about anything. A lot of people make it funny, a lot of people make it sad or whatever. But then I was like, okay, let's write about this. And that's when I wrote about the things that happened with my dad, and all this anger came out. My first draft, it was so angry. And when I read it, I was like, wow, is this the kind of person that I want to be? And I was like, no. And this and that, it was so interesting. It was the first time this ever happened to me, but I started writing it again. And then I was like, well, this is not quite right either. And then I rewrote it and rewrote it for 6 months, 10 drafts of it, until the last draft of it was completely different. It wasn't rage anymore. It was kind of acceptance. Like, I came to a place where I was like, yeah, I love my dad. Mm-hmm. And it was this realization that I had where I was like, wow, things with him are probably, he's probably never going to change the way he is. But all I knew was I wanted a dad. And all I could do was clean up my side of the street. And so then that's how I came to peace with it. And I realized, oh, wow, like looking at him, he went through a lot. And he didn't have the tools to handle it. And so then, of course, something like that is going to come out. And I think a big realization for me was he's my dad, but he's not a Superman. Like, he's a human being. And once I forgave him for his mistakes was when I was like, yeah, he's a human being. And then I came to peace with it. And then, so then I wrote this monologue, I performed it in the class, and it was like this weight that I just let off my chest. And then I was like, what's the next step now? And then I was like, well, I have to talk to him about it. Yeah, so then, I took him out for a walk, and then like at that stage, like, we still didn't even really have a relationship. One of the things I realized from writing this monologue was that we really disconnected ever since I was 10. No father-son time, no anything. Like, he supported us, but there was no emotional relationship there whatsoever. And like, I think some of my resentment was there too, where I was like, yeah, I wish I played catch with my dad. Like, how come everybody else got that and I don't? But then the way I saw it after the monologue was, damn, he must feel really guilty. Like, there has to be this, like, shame and guilt there too. And that was for me, that was a light at the end of the tunnel where I was like, yeah, maybe if I approach him with love, then he will see that too. And so then I took him out on this walk, and then we were just talking, and I was like, oh, hey, dad, what was it like for you growing up? He told me about his childhood, and he was very poor, and his dad was like very strict, kind of Japanese style, like, parent raising, because in Japan colonized Taiwan for a little while. And I asked him, like, oh yeah, dad, did everything happen with you and your dad getting hit or anything? And he was like, oh no, not at all. He was actually, you know, quite kind to me. And then I told him, hey, yeah, you remember when you used to beat me? And he was like, oh no, not really. Not at all. And then I was like, oh, you did. And then he ended up confessing. Like, he said, yeah, you're right, I did. And I said, yeah, it happened for a real long time. And then he was like, yeah, I know. And I'm sorry. Like, I was going through so much at the time. And life for me back then was like this and that. And then I was like, dad, don't worry about it. I just want to let you know I forgive you. And then from that moment on, it was like I had a father. Looking back at it now, I think it was because I wrote that monologue. If I had approached him with a lot of that rage that I would just reactionarily have, then I don't think that conversation would have gone the way it did. So it was so transformative. It was just so transformative being able to have art be that for you. And that is what acting and stuff means to me, because I realized how much you can understand yourself. You can understand the people around you and what truth is. Like, what does it mean to see things past what you would just emotionally react to? Yeah, anyway, I forget what your question.
It was about, you had mentioned the trauma. And so you were describing that, but I just want to take a moment to acknowledge you for doing that is brave and courageous and so self-aware at that time. And to do that and to have a adult, like engaging and productive conversation with your dad, that is, that's so raw and scary, I think.
It's very, like
even
very
me,
scary.
I don't know this about you, Kenny, though we've been friends so long. And for me to be here and hear that is like scary for me, you know? So for you to say that, wow, it's, just.
Thank you for saying that. I think it's about having courage, because everybody has their own big dragon to face. And then I think one part of me was always like, I don't really have anything to lose, I think. I think subconsciously, I believe that. And so then it wasn't even so much courage that pushed me through. It was, I think this is what it means to live. Like, you have to find those things that are the scariest to you and then face it, because then at the end of that tunnel is something wonderful. And ever since then, and I'm not going to say that it was just like night and day.
Right.
Not a movie. And I'm still finding things that I'm like, wow, that's a leftover from that time. Like, the way I see things, like there's still like smaller pieces, fragments of, oh, that hasn't healed yet. Or that could, oh, that's coming from there. Okay, I got it. Okay, I know how to handle it now.
Thank you for sharing that. That's just a very powerful life experience. And you turn something that could be so damaging to something that you've actually are dealing with. And have made it something very productive in rebuilding that relationship. One thing I did want to ask you, and for some reason it popped into my head now as you were telling that story, is I wanted to ask you a little bit about, because we talked about all these activities you did growing up. We didn't talk about wushu, and we didn't talk about learning martial arts. And the longest time that I've known you, I've associated wushu with you. So
oh
we've gone
my
now
gosh.
For, you know, however, 45 minutes, and we haven't talked about that. So talk to me a little bit about you and wushu and how you picked it up and stuff like that. Give me a little bit of sense how you got into it.
For sure.
And how serious you were at, like, over the course.
Wushu was a childhood dream, too. We grew up in a Chinese household, and so then my mom would watch, like, those soap operas with all the high-flying xia style martial arts. We would watch Jackie Chan. We would watch Stephen Chow. Jackie Chan, we would call 很厉害 the uncle, which translates to like the incredible, talented uncle. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Chow would be the 很好笑 the uncle, which is the really funny uncle.
Yeah.
I grew up with those, and they all have some kind of martial arts involved. And there's a lot of those Shaolin stories. And it was to a point where I told my mom, I remember I was like 8 years old or something, and I was like, Mom, can you drop me off at a Shaolin monastery and just leave me there? And then I remember saying that to her like several times, and she would just laugh. And then so that I always had this connection to it. And then we did like the McDojo Taekwondo classes when you're growing up. That didn't really stick. Didn't really care about that. But then actually it wasn't until college that I actually found martial arts and wushu.
Oh.
Yeah, and the only reason
you didn't really do it as a younger kid.
No.
You just did it here and there. Like,
not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I found it because a friend of mine, my freshman year, he was like, oh, yeah, there's this thing called wushu. And then I was like, what the frick is wushu? And he goes, it's this thing that like Jet Li and Jackie Chan does. At that point, my freshman year, I had gained like 10 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Like, really and so I like had to.
Pretty good for freshman year.
Yeah, freshman 15.
Yeah.
And I was like, God, I gotta lose some weight. And so I'm like, I went and then did a little bit. And then I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then for me, like Berkeley engineering is very intense and very stressful.
Mm-hmm.
And the wushu that I was doing gradually became my emotional outlet. Like, it was like my only way to express myself, because the regiment was so tough curriculum wise and studying wise. And yeah, like it, for a while, it really just became my emotional outlet. And so then I practiced for 4 years at Berkeley, and then I was teaching there after I graduated a little bit. And then as I was doing the startup and the acting at even after the acting, I was practicing martial arts at night. Like, I was practicing 3 hours a day, and it was exhausting, because I remember I'd nap in the car after I drove for like an hour or two from San Francisco to the Bay Area to go train at my Kung Fu school. But I just needed it. I got to a point where I made onto the US team. That was pretty awesome. So then I was on it for 2 years. So 2010 to 2012, I was competing like all over the world. And
this is after college then?
Yeah, this was after college that I made the team. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so this is also like around the time you were getting into acting as well?
Mm-hmm.
So you were doing all the acting and also excelling at Wushu in this competitive level.
Yeah, wow. Really tough. But I didn't know any other way. It was just like, this is what I wanted. I wanted the startup to do well. I wanted my acting to go. I wanted to do martial arts. And so that was all I lived and breathed for many years. That was like 3 or 4 years, give or take, in the Bay Area. So yeah, that was amazing. And then I started really late for Wushu. Wushu is like super acrobatic. It's super stylized, and it's so intricate and so much to learn, so much different styles. And so it takes literally like a lifetime of learning. I really, at the time, I was practicing it just strictly because I needed it. And now it's when I moved to Los Angeles, there's a period of time where I was like, okay, I can't have myself be seen as this martial artist, because I was worried about stereotypes, and I was already getting offers to like, can you do this action thing? And a lot of the action things were not acting related.
So like stunt work, you mean?
It wasn't even stunt work. It was, oh, this short film is like, we want to do this action thing. It wasn't a stunt thing, because the action wasn't going to be good. It's like an action type film that was going to be garbage. It was going to be horrible, because they didn't know what they were doing. Because it takes like a stunt choreographer and all talented martial artists in order to have that happen. But I've been on too many projects where it was like, okay, well, this guy is horrible and he thinks he's good, but so it's not going to be good, because it takes action and reaction for something to look great.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then there's a long time where I was like, okay, I can't have anybody know that I do martial arts. And so I hid it for until about last year or 2 years ago, practicing on my own and not even doing it seriously, and really turned my back on it, because I wanted to establish myself as an actor. Now that I've done that, I actually started getting back into it a little bit, and was taking some Kung Fu classes, Wushu classes, at Shaolin Wushu Center on La Brea in Los Angeles with Master, who is like legitimately old school China style, like martial arts. He's a very good teacher. I still love going there. But then I had something happened to my knee, and I had to have total knee reconstruction surgery. And then that to me told me that, okay, look, you need to let this thing go. So then I was like, okay, yeah. And I really said my goodbyes to it, where I was like, yeah, I'm just an actor now. I'm not a martial artist whatsoever. Cause I tried coming back, and this is what it told me. And then, so I completely quit until I started working on Yakuza Princess, which is this action thriller that my wife, Masumi, became the lead on. And I was there to just help her pull her coffee and teach her martial arts, because she had never done action anything before. And I became friends with the director and the producer, and then they saw me teaching her, and then they were like, oh, wow, and they end up casting me in the part. But anyway, long story short, the producer on that set, her name is Tubaldini Shelding, she pulled me aside after we finished shooting. And she was like, Kenny, I need to tell you something. And I was like, yeah, sure, shoot. And then she told me, look, like, you have to embrace this martial arts side of you, because I think it would be a shame if you didn't. And then it's that theme again of like people coming into your life and waking you up and finding you in a way. And ever since that moment, I was like, wow, you're right. That I've like fully gotten back into it. And so then I feel like she saved me in a way.
I'm so glad that you've done that.
Yeah,
because I can't wait to see what you have going on. So Well, maybe let's talk a little bit about that. Yeah. Talk a little bit. And I know the last couple things I know you've been in was the big Roland Emmerich movie. And then you have, is it A Shot Through the Wall? Yeah. Oh, and congratulations. I'm seeing that you got, I guess you're up for some acting award at a film festival. That's amazing to see that. To have that recognition, I think, is just wonderful. And then you were in the Nat Geo TV series. But tell me a little bit more about Yakuza the Princess. And tell me, because I feel like just hearing about it from you, it seems like almost like this kind of very beautiful culmination and an ability to really showcase all the dimensions that you have, not only as an actor, but also in your personal life. You're able to have this dimension because you were able to work with your wife, Masumi.
Yeah. Wow. The Yakuza Princess story is a huge one. Oh, wow. How do I get into that? Basically, I met my wife, Masumi, on a commercial shoot. And then we, long story short, we started dating pretty soon after that. And then within 3 or 4 months, she proposed to me. And before that, I was like, I'm probably not going to get married for a very long time until I was like 50 or something. But then it just, things just matched with us. Anyway, so then she proposed and then we were engaged for a couple of months. And then she's a singer-songwriter that started doing acting a little bit. And because I was an actor, I was like teaching her some things here and there. She met my agent and my manager and then they really liked her. So they hip-pocketed her and setting her out on auditions. Anyway, like a month or two after she got hip-pocketed, she auditions for Yakuza Princess. And it's for the leading role of, it's like a coming-of-age story almost of this girl who realizes that she's royalty of this Yakuza family in Japan. And she lives in Brazil. Anyway, so it's like super heavy, action-oriented. And she ends up booking it. And so we're all like super happy. And we end up getting hitched, like we moved like our civil ceremony date that was gonna fall on the shoot date to right before. So we got married 2 days before we left for shooting in Brazil. And so we went there, and then she has a month to get her action stuff ready. She'd never done action before. I was teaching her boxing and kickboxing and martial arts and all the fundamentals so that she would feel comfortable and safe. I didn't want her getting hurt at all during any of this because she had a lot of her action to do. Even though they have stunt doubles, it's always best if she knows the actions too. So then I was teaching her alongside, I was supplementing like the coach that they had on set. Like they had a whole house that they rented out for just training and doing all the action scenes and whatever. And I sat there with her every day holding her coffee and was just like watching and like seeing what their process was. And it was really fascinating to me. And it's all, I always just love being on set. And then and I was really happy to just be her assistant and pop in and teach her like extra tips. She's the type of person who's like very thorough and she wanted to make sure she's doing everything right. And so then after we trained during the day, we would come home and then we're in a hotel and we'd go to the gym. And then she would be working and practicing her steps and I'd give her homework too. And then we'd go over what she learned that day. It was very involved. And in a way, I put my acting aside for this because I knew that I've been the lead of a film before and I know how much pressure it is. And for her, who's never had a role before ever, to be the lead, it's a lot of pressure. And she's doing something completely new. So then I wanted to take care of her and make sure that she felt comfortable and confident enough to be able to do something like this. And so I was like, you know what, this is going to be a full-time thing. So I completely didn't really take any auditions for myself. And then, and the reason why I say that is for me, it came very naturally. It just made a lot of sense. But then I think like my agents, my reps saw that, but then the director and the producers saw that too on that set. The director's name is Vicente and Tuba, who I mentioned already, is the producer. They just saw me hanging out every day and probably were worried that this guy is going to get in the way. He's overprotective or something. But then I was super cool and like I trusted them. It was just that I was just there to help her out and make her feel comfortable emotionally. I guess they saw something in me from that. I don't know. But then like within a month, like they were like, yeah, who is this guy? Maybe they're talking about me or something. And then and they looked me up and they're like, oh, shoot, he's an actor.
You hadn't told them anything.
No, I didn't tell them anything.
Besides your Masumi's husband.
Yeah, I was holding her coffee. I don't want to distract. There's so many things going on. You know, and then they're like, this guy's a freaking actor. He's done like all these like things. And then they saw me training her and realized, oh, his martial arts is pretty good too. They rescinded a part that they gave to this other guy.
Oh, whoa.
And they gave it to me. Yeah. And then they made the part bigger. So I was like, oh, that's really, really cool. So then I've got like the size of a part now that I get to act with my wife this movie. So it became a freaking dream come true. It was like a paid honeymoon in a foreign land shooting a movie. She's the lead. It was quite beautiful and amazing. And it was very stressful too, because so much was going on and we didn't get much chances to talk and process it, but it really was like this dream come true. And so I ended up getting like this really great part because of that. And then they were like, we want you to choreograph something too. And so I got to choreograph a fight sequence with me and Masumi.
All right.
So, yeah, I don't want to spoil anything, but then like we have this really great fight scene and it's the climax of the film. And yeah. And so then it was basically a dream come true. And it was really a culmination of everything at that point. It was me realizing what's important in life. And I feel like the desperate version of Kenny that first came to LA and was like, I have to make it.
Yeah.
Would have made different choices. And yeah. And it really further cemented to me this idea that you know what you believe in, what you stand for. And if you stand by that, then things come. Like you're gonna be able to support yourself.
Do you know when that movie is coming out?
It's coming out the middle of this year. The only reason why they're holding it back right now is because they want to be able to release in theaters.
Right.
They recently got, I don't know if the right word is acquired, but XYZ, who's going to be a great sales agent for them internationally. So we're hoping it does well in the United States as well as Japan and Brazil. And it's an English language film, even though it's shot in Brazil and it's a Brazilian team.
Cool. I can't wait for that. XYZ knows what they're doing. So especially for a film like this, I can't wait for it. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited for you and Masumi, of course.
Yeah, it was so cool. Amazing. And then COVID hit, like after we got back.
I have to remark upon hearing that story, I think not only you and how you approached that whole film upon being supportive of Masumi, but I think it speaks to the volumes of the collaborators that you had on that project, of the director and of Tuba to get to know you, because making a movie is so difficult. So they have a lot of other things going on too, because they're making this movie. And then once you get into production, the movie is like a train that has departed the station. You just keep going. So for them to have gotten to know you, for them to then realize your talent, and then to change a part, to change the production.
Yeah.
Wow, that is pretty amazing to hear that story and to see that actually happen. And they were quick on their feet and smart and executed that. Mm-hmm. That's
definitely
a brilliant story.
I give the credit to them, honestly. Like the Sensei is an incredible director. Like he deals with a lot of things because action films are not easy and even more moving parts than just a regular film. But he handles all of it like really well. He knows what he wants. And then he's also very kind to the people that he works with. Mm-hmm. He was so kind to Masumi. He knew that she was completely new to acting. In fact, they actually had originally offered it to this K-pop star. And Tuba, I trust nothing but my instinct. She was like, I'm casting Masumi instead, after she saw Masumi's tape. And she rescinded the part and gave it to Masumi. So there was like even extra pressure to perform. But then Vicente took such good care of her, and Tuba was always present and always, I'm sure she was dealing with even more things I didn't even know about. But then, she really adapted well to everything. And they're incredible people, and I'll work with both of them again in a heartbeat. And Tuba says the same thing to me to this day. She's asking me like, we need to shoot something. And I want to loop all these really wonderful people that I've found. So that's life for me.
Now, I wanted to add, off of that, hearing about the Yakuza Princess and your experience there, can you share a little bit about the differences and similarities that you saw in shooting a film in Brazil? And it's not Hollywood, I'm guessing. It's the Brazilian system. And if you could just talk a little bit about that. And the reason I'm curious about that is because, based on my experience having worked and lived abroad in China and in Hong Kong and Taiwan, that's one thing that I really encourage everyone to explore, like working internationally. But I would say especially us as Asian Americans to explore that, because the working internationally, of course, is so different, and getting an experience, I think, outside of Hollywood is so important.
Right,
share a little bit about that experience similarities and differences in what you learned?
There's so many. Like just going to a different country for several months, it's you really do live there for a while. So there's a living situation, switching and adapting to the area. We were in Sao Paulo for most part, and parts of Sao Paulo are not very safe. And they made sure we were aware of that because they didn't want us to get hurt or mugged. But then in terms of the industry, you know, it's a smaller country than America's got a lot of rules that they put in place to make sure people are safe. And so then in Brazil, it's a little bit more loose than that. And I'm sure the same thing in China too. You have to look out for yourself in a way. That being said, they took really good care of us. And I don't know if it's like the normal experience in Brazil, but then they knew that we were American actors and we maybe expected things a certain way. And so they were constantly making sure that we were happy and we were good. But overall, it actually didn't feel terribly different besides most of those things. I think we were quite insulated too, because Masumi is a star, and they knew that it was the first time for her acting in something, and so they took really good care of us. Like, we had incredible place to live, and it was in the middle of like really great area. We were assigned like a couple of people that were just their job was to take care of us. And there's like kind of the cultural differences that, as somebody who's Asian American, grew up in America, and I constantly felt like you were a guest here and had to blend in at home, blend in the work environment, blend in at school, it was natural. You see through the superficial things of like language and like the way they react to things, and you innately understand how to see people for their humanity. And so then for me, it was easier to adapt than if I think we weren't Asian American or so close to the immigrant experience.
Yeah, I think you hit on something there. I think just because, like you said, we're always like in this like third culture space. You're not really from here. You're not really from there. And so you're used to just rolling with punches. And I guess so that will come out later this year, and really excited for that. And then going forward, is there anything on the horizon that you've, whether it's something that you've booked, what are some roles, what are some stories that you'd love to be involved in?
That's a big subject too. Okay, let's go to the first one. The first one is like what is coming up on the horizon. There's a lot of things. I found out recently that I'm going to be playing one of the characters in this new Ubisoft game called Hyperscape. It's like Fortnite, but then they're like next generation of things. I was doing the voices for that recently, and they gave me like a whole likeness of me, so maybe it's not even going to be my face really, but at least I'm doing the voice acting for it, so I think that's really cool. And my film Shot Through the Wall right now is playing through a whole lot of film festivals, like a bunch of them were like I'm not even keeping track of. But yeah, this is a drama that I did several years ago. It's like a historical fiction where it's very much inspired by a real story, the Peter Liang case. Long story short, he's a New York City police officer, a rookie Asian American, Chinese American cop who accidentally shoots and kills a black man, and in the midst of like Black Lives Matter. And for him, it was truly an accident. Like he's made to go into this foot patrol of this really rundown area of New York. And he goes into this dark stairwell and he hears this noise. He accidentally discharges his firearm into a wall. This bullet ricochets around the staircase, goes down a flight of stairs and hits this man in the chest that he didn't even know was there. And this man dies from it. And Peter Liang is the one that is the only cop in 20 years to get indicted for manslaughter. Our story is inspired by that case. A cop who accidentally shoots and kills somebody. Him and his whole family needs to deal with the repercussions of all of that. Because then obviously Black Lives Matter movement and Black people, Black Americans are saying, we have to stop killing us, which makes a whole shitload of sense. And then there's the other side that is like the cops saying, we're not the bad guys here, and they're trying to cover their own ass. And then in the middle, this Asian American, Chinese American family that is, he just wanted to be a cop to serve his community. And what does race have to do with this and all that stuff? And
So
it's a very heavily loaded subject and a film that I think is very relevant to now. And it's been going on the film festival circuit. And it's always nice hearing that we won something. And most recently, I was nominated for Best Actor. The director was nominated for Best Director. We were nominated for Best Film at the Beaufort Film Festival in South Carolina. We found out that we won Best Film.
Wow. Congrats. Yes. I love that.
Yeah. So it's cool. It's crazy because I
shot that film like quite a long time ago. So yeah, so that's happening. And then right now I'm in talks for a TV show that you are involved in, Jason, and a couple of other films that spawned from that discussion, actually. So
it's cool.
Quite exciting. And again, it's affirming this idea of working with people that you really connect to. And that's what makes me happiest. And so it's just rolling itself. Yeah.
This is so cool because I feel like I've discovered or I've gotten to know this other side, other layer of Kenny. But I will say on A Shot Through the Wall, I would say it's a serious subject matter, like you said. Mm-hmm. And I will say my takeaway from it, I watched it a couple months ago and I recall it, and not just because it was a well-directed film, it was a good story, you had a great performance in it, but I think it's an important subject matter and an important story. But I think it also is this really interesting thing that it's such a human story and such a thoughtful story on a subject matter that actually right now, when you read about it in the news and you see how it's covered, it's insanity. Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. What is going on? And then for this film, you guys were able to create something like it's art, right? It's fiction. It is a story that you guys felt that was very socially relevant, and you created this character and the story. And it's so heavy that you've managed to make it both a message that's incredibly timely important, and it's well done, but there's actually, it serves that, I think, a very beautiful balance between art, commerciality, and also purpose. And so that was my takeaway from it. But it's interesting to see that because this film is such a small kind of indie film. You guys still really aren't picked up. So it's just a passion project for this director. But for me, I watch so many films, and there's so many films that are film festivals. I think there's something about this one. So I really hope that it continues to have global success that you guys are starting to see it have.
We hope so too. And I completely agree with you. I think Amy, the director, she's the writer and director and producer of it. She really had something that she wanted to say. And I think what we do forget in this mire of like constant news and politics, and I think politics is infecting everybody's lives. I think we sometimes forget that ultimately it's about what is important on a human level. Yeah, this story really digests all of that mess and ultimately ends up saying something I think is very clear, which is look, like there's people that are dying. Like, what is more important than trying to stop that? Yeah.
I want to touch upon like representation and stories of the Asian diaspora or of Asian Americans. But I guess instead of talking about where we are or we can be going, I'm more curious in a conversation that we've had is about you writing stories or us finding stories that we can work on. What's that been like for you? Any recent thoughts about that?
When I first came to LA, I think as an Asian performer, you're so hungry for just any kind of representation. The lack of representation made me, like way back in my high school, made me realize or made me feel like, oh, I'll never have a future as an actor or as a performer. So you're really hungry for just any kind of representation. But then as you keep on working at it, I think what I've come to realize is that the type of representation that we need is ones that we create. Like, it's not just about finding and getting representation, because in a way, representation is sticking a Chinese actor in this blockbuster film and just sticking her in there. Oh, there's a Chinese face. Okay, great. But that, to me, still...
Check the box. I've done the work.
And I feel like people do sense that's okay, well, that's coming out of nowhere. What is the meaning of that? There's no purpose except for checking a box. I've realized that the representation is so important, not for that, because that's meaningless, but it's that our own stories need to come out. And not just that, but we need to be the ones to tell it. Because it's not about the reward of the representation. It's about the journey that we need to go on in telling that story of representation, because nobody else can tell it. I would be really dissatisfied if somebody that was Caucasian wrote this incredible story about this Asian person and he wrote it and that was successful. Some part of me would be very dissatisfied with that, because I'm like, wow, I wish that one of us had done that. Because mm-hmm. for me, it's about, I wish that that person had gone through that transformation. I wouldn't resent this if he was a Caucasian writer. I wouldn't resent him for doing it, but I would feel like, oh, I wish that one of us had done it.
Or a collaboration.
Yeah, or a collaboration, exactly. Or like you got assisted from it, because I want somebody to go through that transformation. Because for me, it's not about the end result. My own relating to my own journey with what art was or is, that it's fundamentally transformative. And I want that for people like me. And that's why I feel like it's our responsibility to write our own stories. We can't ask people to like just stick us into movies. That's meaningless. That's besides the point. The real purpose is for us to make this. And that's why it's, for me, it's a responsibility, but it's also, you know, what we have to do, like what we're meant to do. It's facing like the scariest thing of us. It's these types of stories I think ultimately will make us matter.
What you just said as I was hearing you talk about it, I would say the two words that stuck out to me is when you talked about the transformation and the journey. Because I think that's a lot when you talk about like representation. You think we just want to see the face on screen, the checkbox, but that's not what it's about. That's on maybe a very superficial surface level, what it manifests as. But what it really is, what you're saying, it's about that transformation, about that expression of who you are, and then the journey in life. I think it's so interesting for me to hear you verbalize these thoughts and these ideas that you have, because I can see that you've thought about it, that you've taken the time to reach this point, and it's through your experiences that you've arrived at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. That was something that I felt like I had to find. Like you work so hard as an actor and an artist, and in order to be competitive, you have to dedicate your life to it. I really had to find the reason for why this exists. And to me, it becomes like, it has to become spiritual in a way. For me, it has, because this does feel transformative. Like this, I can see myself dedicating my life to, because it's not just useful, but then also is helpful for everybody. That's what I hope anyway. Like I want to create things that like mean something to people.
You just said spirituality, but that's actually in the back of my mind as we've been talking. Like that's something that I felt just in the stories and then just what you're saying from the beginning till now, there is like this spiritual journey, which is very beautiful, because that's also like another metaphor in terms of what we talked about, like martial arts or wuxia movies. There is this spiritual journey. That's very fun and beautiful that you have that. To wrap this up, what recent films or TV shows have you seen that have inspired you? What would you recommend?
That's a really good question. Depending on what I'm thinking about, things always stick out to me. Oh man, I'm embarrassed to say this, but then actually a lot of
anime is great.
Not because I feel like I have a judgment towards it, but maybe just how much it does mean to me actually. Because I mean, in college was when I first found anime, and a lot of the stories are, I think, just beautifully written. I think better than a lot of films, and I've seen like the best ones. And yeah, like there's several that capture something that I feel like is something that's a little bit fundamentally different from the West. That's something innate in like my upbringing or Asianness or whatever, but then it says something different to me. It has something different to say to me. So then I recently had a Rurouni Kenshin binge, which is like this old television series, but then the movie itself was, I think, just so well done. A director I always love talking about is an animation film director named Satoshi Kon, who is most known for Paprika, but he did a bunch of other films too, that Christopher Nolan's Inception was inspired by Paprika. Perfect Blue is another film that he did that Darren Aronofsky bought the rights to so that he could take like sequences from it. Perfect Blue is also very similar to Black Swan. So he's kind of like this unknown director, at least in the West, that people have taken a lot of inspiration from. The way he tells stories is just always so interesting. And Cowboy Bebop is another one that really hits me in another way too.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of aspects to so many different films that just strikes you in a different way. And depending where you are in your life too. I think Star Wars recently, actually for me, episodes 4 through 6. No, yeah. Actually, like 4 and 5. That really took me somewhere too. And yeah, so then I was really on mythological binge like last year was really like really was a part of that journey.
What's the name of the director again?
Satoshi Kon, K-O-N.
K-O-N. Yeah. Okay, I'll have to look that up. I think that's great, and to know that there are all these much more famous directors that have drawn inspiration from him. I think that is something that I find really interesting because like that's something that you don't hear a lot about. We should go back and we should discover these people.
Yeah, there's so many Western films that are inspired by Eastern films, and I'm sure vice versa too. But then it sucks when you're like, wow, it was based on this Asian property and nobody knows about it. Infernal Affairs. People have to watch that if you.
Oh yeah, that was where I was gonna go next. Yeah.
Yeah, yep. Love Infernal Affairs. What's another one? Oh, even Chow Yun-fat in City of Fire was the one that inspired Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino.
I just saw that recently. I didn't know that was the inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you did? You saw that recently? I haven't seen it yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went on a lot of Chow Yun-fat old films. This was like a couple months ago I was doing that.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I have to catch those.
Yeah, my advice would to you, if you can't find it online, get a library card. And at least LA has a really good library. They have all these old classics that you can find and then you can check them out on DVD.
Oh, wow. That's really good.
I like the DVD because nowadays on streaming, you don't get all these bonus features. Yeah. And sometimes you get commentary tracks like by the director or the making of featurettes. And especially for these old films, it's really cool to see just their thought process behind the movies.
That's really dope.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Thanks, Jason.
Well, thank you, Kenny. I really appreciated it. And then this is the first episode. I couldn't have asked for more from this. Accomplished everything that I shared with you that I wanted to do and more. Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. It's always an honor being a guinea pig and, happy to be on the show.
All right. I'll end this now. And thanks again.
All right. Love you, Jason.
All right. All right. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to thank Kenny as my first guest. Thanks for an amazing discussion. In addition, I want to give special thanks to my friend John Erho for encouraging me and helping me brainstorm this podcast on our weekly long hikes in LA. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or questions, please DM me. Follow us on social, and if you have any questions, tips, creative suggestions, for designs, logos, music, or other creative elements for this podcast, please reach out to me. You can also email me at thelinsidershow@gmail.com. If you enjoy this episode, please help me spread the good word of this podcast by giving a rating and sharing on social media. Thanks, y'all. Much love, and see you next time.